There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The parallel economy has empowered us to care for our health, well-being, as well as longevity. Likewise for us pet parents who now have a place to go when it comes to keeping the family dogs, cats, even horses in the best shape possible. As a dog dad, I'm thrilled to be working with Pet Club 24/7, a company founded by two guys who lost dogs to serious conditions, including cancer. Pet Club 24/7 has an incredible array of products, including a line of supplements for humans, such as the Inforce Plus Corollius Versicolor and Inforce Corollius Versicolor with Reishi. My friend and colleague, Christina Ferrari, a cancer survivor herself, swears by it.
When I was diagnosed, the doctor in the emergency room told me, "You have 2 years to live."
Oh boy.
Along with the stem cell, I took these. I have been in remission for 8 years now.
For dogs, mush puppy treats are a fan favorite. Rex, you want to? Oh boy. He came right. Oh, there he is. They are also made with the Corollius versicolor mushroom, which supports their immune system, according to hundreds of clinical studies. Here's Kristen Ludlow, National Vice President.
That strain does matter. We do have the most potent strain, and we also extract it in a proprietary way. And that's why we've been having such wonderful experiences with these products.
Mush puppies are made here in the U.S. There are no fillers. It's non-addicting. Your dog can't accidentally overdose. Go to drdrew.com/petclub247 for a discount off the list price. That is drdrew.com. PETCLUB247, Pet Club 247.
Hey, Dr. Drew here, and this is just a reminder that the discussions here are not a substitute for medical care or medical evaluation. This is purely for entertainment and education. We hope you learn something, but see your doctor, get proper medical care.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
That's right. Welcome to This Life. Hashtag you live. Today's co-host, Bob Forrest at Rehab Bob Forrest, and Shelley Sprague, ss@shelleysprague.com. Is that? That's your
right.
Email.
I know.
I just gave out your email.
That's okay. It's all good.
All right. Is there a Twitter handle?
No, I don't have one.
Okay. Well, then give it your email. It's going to.
We're going to get it all going when she has her own podcast here in a couple weeks.
Bobby, my biggest fan.
Welcome, guys. Shelley is at the Bel Air Recovery Center. Tell us how we can get there.
BelairTreatment.com.
Take the 405 freeway north from the valley.
Get off on
Sunset.
When you see the, what's the Skirball Center, you're about there.
You're almost there.
Anything else you want to go over? Anything you guys want to talk about quickly in terms of your promoting your own stuff? Or cause I got a bunch of business I got to handle here?
Yeah, just the detox in Encino and BelairTreatment.com. And... we're expanding. We went to Melrose, 83 Melrose as well, for LGBTQ and outpatient treatment.
Great.
Did you know that the house they have the detox in is the Sober House from Sober House?
Did you know that?
No. Did you know that?
Yes.
That's the house Shelley's
which
got
one?
Now.
The first one?
The second one. The one in the valley.
Up the big steep. The valley.
No, the valley.
The one in the valley. It has that big one.
Yes, with the swimming pool.
Oh, my God. With
remember
the Starbucks
the mirrors,
down the street.
The mirrors in the living room? Are they still there?
No.
The reason I'll never forget, no one saw that one. It was just Bob and I going there to treat those patients.
Yeah, I ran some groups there as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And why I remember it so vividly is there was a Starbucks down the street, and I went and I talked to the manager, got job applications, Mr. Codependent. I brought him back, and I had it all clear.
Trying to get drug addicts that are in sober living a job. Like, how are you going to do that?
I had it all free and clear, and I said, here, all you can do is fill out this one page, and you're hired.
One application.
Not one of them filled. I couldn't believe it.
Starbucks was beneath that.
Oh, yes, honey.
Starbucks was way beneath that.
So that's Shelley's detox now.
All right. Please do go to doctor.com and click through on the Hydrolite banner. You know these guys. You get 30% off on your purchase with the code DREW18 at checkout. And we've also have special prices on Bergamot. The banner there at doctor.com give you a discount when you click through. And we have them, thankfully, back on the show with us. I just pimped them out on Shelley, gave them to her. She's got the Bergamot Femme, and Susan takes the Bergamot Femme every day, and it's a good product. Share the show, like us on Facebook, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and at YouTube, and
help your friends with this information that we're going to hopefully get through today. One more thing, check out KBC 790 Midday Live. That is Monday through Friday, me and Lawrence Savon. Mike is now over at K-Rock, and Mike and I have a new podcast called Swole Patrol. You can check that out. Subscribe, tell a friend. The Lawrence Savon Show is 12 to 3 Pacific. It's also on 790 in Los Angeles and KGO in San Francisco. And you can tune in live at kbc.com. Or if you missed it, we've got the podcast at drdrew.com. Again, calls today, 323-649-8268. Now let's get to our guest. Todd Zalkins, addiction specialist, interventionist, award-winning filmmaker. The new film is The Long Way Back. You can watch it at thelongwaybackfilm.com, or it is on Hulu, which is a big deal.
That's a big deal.
Todd is
That's
a cool. Yeah, KDOC. He's an addiction specialist, life coach, interventionist, public speaker, published a work, author. Let's see. Todd's All In Intervention has earned a reputation as one of the nation's leading intervention recovery developers. He has a team of specialists with over 60 years of experience. And Dying for Triplicate. That's that's your book, right? Your memoir.
That's right.
Dying for
they don't have triplicates anymore.
Oh, no. Well, we have something like that. We still have a stupid
No,
form.
You can't get the pharmacy to give them to you.
That's been out for 8 years. That was my came up before the film.
Yeah. Tell us about the film.
Well, the Long Way Back came out on October 17th and first came out on Amazon and Google Play. And the film chronicles my 17-year addiction and recovery to prescription painkillers. It also blends in my relationship with the Long Beach scene, of course, where I grew up, and my relationship with the band Sublime and our music culture.
And your son.
Brad's
son.
Brad's son.
Yeah, Bradley Knoll's son. I was with Brad on the night that he died and broke all of our hearts. And a full circle story. I got clean and sober many years later and became an interventionist. And I was there to answer the call when Jacob Knoll needed help.
That's just the most.
And that's what the movie's
thing.
about his recovery. Or
it's got multiple layers. It focuses on not only my story of recovery and my own redemption from not being able to take Bradley Knoll's call, who tried to call me on the night that he died, and also the opioid crisis that we have here in our country, and also being able to help Jacob Knoll get clean and sober. We have many storylines throughout the film, and it's a feature-length documentary, about 95 minutes.
Let's jump right there.
It's and so good.
Todd, you tell me if you have this thing. I couldn't take the call because you were busy, you have kids, you're doing life. You can't beat yourself up about not taking Brad's call.
Well, you were loaded too, though, right?
I was loaded. I just dropped him off.
Back and forth sober, weren't you, or no?
No, I had never been sober, and this is on the night that he died. I just dropped him off in San Francisco on the evening of their last show up in Petaluma, California. I was at his booking manager's house, three blocks away.
And so the idea is, well, we all carry a lot of guilt because I've had a lot of friends die that I coulda, woulda, shoulda. You have to, like, just do what you can where you are. I had a great mentor named Buddy Arnold. I don't know if you knew him.
You bet.
Right.
Yeah.
So Buddy saw the first person I tried to help, Shelly was there, got sober, right? I'm like a year sober. I helped this musician that nobody thought could get sober, and he got sober. Then everybody's giving me act like Bob's got a miracle worker. He got so-and-so sober. So then I'm believing it. Shelly's more sober than me. Then a guy dies.
Same guy.
No, another guy.
And
I was sitting in my office at MAP. I think you were there.
Musician Assistance Program.
And I was really disillusioned. Buddy came in and said, listen to me, if you're going to take credit for the sobriety, you're going to have to take responsibility for the death. You want that? And I was like, no, I don't want that. And he goes, you had nothing to do. You just did your part with so-and-so.
Yeah.
And it worked out. So most times it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think, though, in active addiction, one of the biggest problems is that I had no coping skills, and so my addiction spiraled further for many years.
You used because you thought you weren't there for Brad.
Well, I was an active addict anyways. However, it was compounded as a result of, you know, losing him. I was a broken kid. I had no coping skills. Zero. I couldn't cope with grief.
I remember I felt bad because I felt like he looked up to LA musicians like me and Anthony and Perry, and we were all heroin addicts. And then this kid dies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it really felt like, what kind of role models are we? Because he's about 10 years younger than me, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow. We got a responsibility. No, let's just do more drugs and forget about it.
But that's always the case is that, you know, something bad happens and what do? We want to do something different, but we can't. We don't have the skills.
Yeah, and especially when you're not sober, you aren't present for anyone anyways. And so so many people just unraveled, and it took a long time in order to not only process the pain and work through a bunch of that stuff. It was a disaster. And so it was a miracle just to get sober and just to be able to be there for other people in general, let alone work through the pain of getting through and getting all those layers.
It's a little why I'm a little surprised that you're still feeling guilt knowing that you're not.
No.
Because you were
– he was.
No, I understand then because but I mean it's just when you're – as a – you know, if I were the caretaker at the time – I would not want him calling another loaded person because who knows what would happen then.
That's all he had.
But I'm just saying it would not have helped. Yeah, you know what I mean? So
it's interesting though. I like what you just said though, Dr. Drew, and that is I wasn't an IV user. He wasn't calling for dope. He wasn't calling for money. He was lonely. Okay. And it wasn't about that. However, I will say this. My heart's still bruised over it. Does that make sense?
Sure. Like, oh, I'm sure because you carried the pain for a long time.
Yeah,
too.
You're still bruised a bit. Yeah, but no, I don't blame myself.
Okay,
no.
Got it.
Big difference.
And that's something we all have to deal with, right? Which is each individual makes their own decisions, right? But we can be examples of hope. That's what I think sobriety is.
Yeah, I agree.
Big time.
Yeah.
Right? Big time. There is no greater feeling than to be able to be a representative of hope for someone who's hopeless. That intangible feeling of hopelessness is just the absolute worst, and to transfer that to someone else to give.
Boy, I just thought of something really kind of interesting, which is that I always, you know, you guys or what inspire me to do the work in abstinence-based recovery, right? You talk about it as hope.
There's only one kind of sober, Drew.
I know, but you guys, you know, I only need to see one Todd to be good to go for a while. You know what I mean?
Right.
We need to give this country that, or all the clinicians that, all the
more.
Doctors that, or something, because they don't see it. They don't know what it is. And they certainly don't know how to help somebody get there anymore. Not my prayers.
How do you navigate that? Because one thing I know is you're a great interventionist, people have told me. So where do you put people? Because you can't trust some rehab centers.
That is so true. I carefully vet the places where I place
– You can't trust Betty Ford. Let me just say it and they can sue me. You cannot trust them.
Why?
What
decent,
are they going to do?
They put people in pain management and then they're on Suboxone. Okay. You've had that experience.
I disagree with people on long-term Suboxone use. Too. I'm really careful as far as I'm glad you brought that up. Where I put people in the treatment, because I'm real leery about the places that are involved in body brokering and all that kind of crap.
You're in Orange County, right?
That's a real sore spot for me. And so I do not work with people who have pending awful lawsuits against them. I like people who have been in business for a long time, small places that really that are not
mom and pop.
Massive mom and pop places who have good hearts, big hearts, who scholarship often. People who are giving it away often when people are broke. You know what I mean? There's a healthy balance there.
So follow me.
But hold on. And also good clinical team, good therapeutic team, all that stuff, the whole nine yards. You know?
But what we try to do is promote those programs.
I will.
Yeah. We're trying to promote those programs. Tim Chapman, I love, in Tustin, right? He has Chapman Recovery. You know, it gets harder and harder because the mom and pops can't survive against the big SEOs and all this kind
of stuff. They're getting eaten alive. They're getting eaten
So we
all
need
the time.
To support the mom and pops.
Yes.
Yeah, because I send people out of California. I can't trust anything. I don't know what and part of it's because I'm not
Stony
there
Brook
vetting them all
is
the time.
Where you send
Springbrook.
Springbrook.
I'm glad that you said that, Dr. Drew, because I'm often sending people out of state for a number of reasons, especially the younger person who needs to get the hell out of their immediate environment.
That's true, to keep them somewhere else.
Not to Florida, though.
No.
Well, do we send I brought
it. You always do the Oregon place.
But listen, I do Utah, a couple other places, but I've been
to
Arizona.
Yep.
And Eric Clapton's place came out of my mouth the other
day.
That's
really hard to get them there, though.
Yeah, I know.
You
gotta have a passport.
I don't mind flying them there.
I'll tell you why I thought
I'm in.
I'll tell you why I'm starting to go back, to refer back down there again. It's because amphetamine. The amphetamine, they're so nutty and so crazy,
they
so intractable. I need them somewhere like away.
Well, I tried to get a musician, a rapper in there. You got to get them from. This kid lived in Westlake Village. I don't even know where that is, but it's a horrible
LA.
Drive.
Off the 101.
So yeah, and so you got to get him. You got to get him stimulant acts, smoking coke. You got to get him to LAX, then fly to Miami.
Oh my
then God. Wait. then get on a different plane to fly to the Bahamas, and he has to have a passport.
Transporting a meth addict is one of the worst. I will not do it. First off, I don't do it personally anymore.
I do it all the time.
I have people transport those situations. I can't do it.
No.
I'll relapse on my own. I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding.
It's fun, though. It's fun. Because they go
Bob,
running
you've
off.
Always thought that was fun.
If I want to go bald, it's fun.
I realized when Bob was chasing Sizemore through the pink dot this was sport for him. He thought it was
Bobby
fun.
He thinks it's because
I'm trying
fun.
To outsmart them.
You think it's so fun. I just want to be in a facility with walls.
Yeah,
and
I like containment.
Real contained, you know. I don't want to be on the streets chasing them through the streets with their craziness.
I had some of the greatest times of my life.
I want to shine a little light on something we've been talking around, make sure people get what we said there, which is that if you're going to refer to the small guys, you have to vet them and revet because these things change depending upon their staff. And I don't refer enough to be able to do that, but I would trust you to do it, so I'll refer to your recommendation.
Yeah. I have to continually stay in touch with them too. Yeah. And I don't have a list of 100.
No,
I'm sure not. I keep my list small and to my hip pocket. Yeah. Gosh darn it, you got to be careful.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yep.
So it's a
strange industry, right? I'm going to speak at a conference in San Francisco on March 2nd, and what I'm going up there to do is to warn about the recovery industry. They think I'm going there as an advocate for the recovery industry. I'm actually saying, you better be very careful. Yeah. About who you choose to get involved with.
Yeah, it scares me when some guy who's got 9 months as a CEO of a rock, of a rocking recovery center, it's like, dude, you haven't even done any work yourself.
Hello. Yeah.
And why do you think I'm going to send you any clients? Are you crazy?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know nothing.
That's what's happening.
Because mom and dad have invested in you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's not happening.
Right.
Bro.
Right.
It happens a lot in Orange County.
All the time.
Yeah. Orange County's really come up. It used to be LA, but now it's Orange County. And, you know, with the Bel Air treatment, the outpatient program, I have tons of experience, and I really try to work that level of you cannot just put these guys on medicines. You have to do the hard work in those group meetings, in those group therapies. You have to do it in the sessions. You have to work these guys.
You're saying, the professionals need
they
to. The team needs
to.
We
have to work with them.
Yeah.
And it's highly competitive, unfortunately, and we're losing people to other treatment centers because of some incentives.
Yeah.
And which is very
scary. That's a nice way of putting it, right?
I like to put things nicely.
there's a guy, I actually called him. So there's a sober living in Santa Monica, right, who's paying $1,000 a head to the addicts if they'll leave the programs like Shelley's who have got the machinery to really make sure that these people are well insured and they can stay for 3 months. They're paying the addicts to leave her program and go to their program.
Is that right?
I didn't say that, but.
Oh, man.
All right, let's take calls.
I didn't say it, but he did.
I'm disgusted.
Man, let's take a call. Wow. Okay.
All right. Let's go to.
Whole new level.
This should be Christina.
Dude, you haven't gotten this phone thing right. Are you there?
Hold on. It takes a minute. That's part of the problem. Christina.
We don't have that kind of patience.
Yes.
There you are.
Hello.
I'm here. I have a question, I think primarily for the first part for Dr. Drew. Is it true that 98% of addicts have been victims of sexual abuse? And to follow that up, maybe for Shelley, Bob, and Todd, do you think the early counseling intervention regarding sexual abuse would help deter drug use and addiction?
Let me work on this one a little bit. Christina, what you're referring to is there's been a lot of sort of semi-press out there about people blaming addiction on trauma. You know, it's all about the trauma. It's all about the trauma. Well, for sure, trauma is a big inciting influence. And by trauma, we mean interpersonal trauma in childhood, physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect. Sexual abuse happens. I wouldn't say it's the most prominent, but it's there. It's common.
Neglect is the big tent.
And neglect is a big one. Physical abuse is pretty ubiquitous. So the trauma is a big, big feature. What trauma does is doesn't allow for the normal development of what we call emotional regulation. You know, we have our emotions, but you also have a system that regulates those emotions. And that's an interpersonal experience. That's how that develops. And if you've been traumatized, you won't enter that frame of interpersonal discourse any longer. And so you don't develop your regulation and you are dysregulated. Now you're dysregulated. You have trauma. You may have parts of yourself walled off that are sort of motivating inappropriate behaviors or acting out. And then you find drugs. And if you're genetically set up for a drug,
and then it has to click.
Then it has to click. It has to, you know, help feel the whatever.
Man, does it click when it clicks, doesn't
and then,
it?
And then off it goes. Yes. So that's a common way addiction evolves. And that's a common way bad addiction evolves. So if you have bad enough addiction that you need to see me, Bob, or Shelley, our aphorism has always been, you had childhood trauma because you're seeing us. That doesn't mean all addicts had childhood trauma.
I don't think it's as high as 98%.
But trauma, I would say, is 90th percentile.
To give it bad addiction. I mean, you could be a truck driver and doing meth.
Telling you, the trauma these kids that we're dealing with, and I don't know what ones you're dealing with, this enmeshment and best friends, parents that are enmeshed in their sex lives and their personal lives and their financial lives, that is a beautiful.
We need to start talking about covert abuse.
So many different levels of emotional trauma exist too. There's so many different variations we can get into.
Yes, and trauma for sure figures in as well. But Christine, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess it does. I realize, obviously drug addiction and abuse needs to be addressed, but could people be reached at an earlier time in their life?
Not if it clicks. If it clicks, it clicks.
No. She's saying, what if you
are before they use
and the kids that were
early
coming
intervention?
Yeah, early intervention for sure is helpful.
I think it's helpful because it's gonna put a frame together for when they are going to get a little bit older and they might start using those strategies.
Here's the problem. The problem is that these kids that come from the families where there's trauma aren't sort of into therapeutic treatments, typically.
Of course.
Number one. And number two, the fact of the trauma makes these kids extremely distrustful and unwilling. Extremely.
Very.
So it's not easy to get an adolescent engaged in anything meaningful around those kinds of issues.
But education, I think education is always a key. And I don't think that there's enough long-term sobriety to really go into those traumatic experiences. We have to get sober first.
Yes,
that's
the other side. Is do you treat the trauma? When do you treat
Please
the trauma?
Please get sober first.
A lot of people get the trauma managed.
Physical sobriety would be nice first.
Yeah, for a long time.
That's right.
And sometimes sobriety done properly, magically you manage a lot of that trauma.
Yeah.
Magically.
Yeah,
But I think it comes to the addict. If you get the addict sober, and you maybe with Brad's son, you've probably done something that I've done with friends of mine's kids who were addicts and died or didn't die but are still addicts, is I push too fast, right? And they're saying, it doesn't really bother me. No, you're making it. I believe that in that moment, it does not bother them. But if you just back off and wait a year or two or three,
so
it will come back up and then you're available to help them.
Absolutely.
The therapist needs to meet the client where they are.
Oh, yeah.
You just nailed
it. And it comes up sometimes, I hate to say it, in God's time. When it's supposed to erupt.
We
cannot force feed those things.
No, I think it's a terrible idea.
Well, that's what treatment does, though. That's what I'm saying.
You cannot force feed it. Hey, you've got trauma. We need to address this now. Good luck.
I was in treatment 24 times, and in my chart, it said that my sister was my mother. These therapists couldn't wait to do a one-on-one with me.
Bob, it's time to process. Now.
Are you still there, Christina?
I think we're much more sophisticated at it nowadays.
Okay, did we get it? We good?
Yeah, I guess it helps. It helps me to understand. I've known people, that from all walks of life, people that have had trauma of all sorts and not become addicted
to drugs.
They don't have the gene.
They don't have this genetic predisposition. That's what we're saying.
Right.
I'm saying you can have here's what I think is happening. We're having relatively trauma-free childhoods now in these bubbles and these echo chambers that kids grow up in. But the parents, no sexual abuse, no physical abuse, none of the stuff that we kind of, our addict generation lived through.
Now it's covert
abuse.
These
kids are covertly abused and enmeshed and neglected. And so it's not overt. It's not sexual abuse. It's not physical abuse, but it's a trauma. And since they have the genetic predisposition, you're talking about exposure rates and becoming heroin addicts at 16 years old.
Yeah, right.
With no sexual abuse history.
I want to say one thing really quick to you, Christine, and I appreciate everything you're bringing up, and that is I want to share openly that I'm a survivor of a tremendous amount of trauma in my childhood, and I can tell you it took a heck of a lot of work. Once I got sober, by the way, it was only until I was about 4.5 or 5 years sober, I was actually willing to do some work behind it. Thank you. And yeah. I was in so much pain, I had a loaded gun to my head at 5 years sober.
Right.
And had I not addressed it, I probably would not be talking to you guys.
Yeah. Right.
Of course.
It's a common thing.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in thinking about friends and family who are active or inactive addicts, it seems to me that there are underlying issues of abandonment, neglect.
Yes.
But
Christine,
the drug use tends to take over, and that becomes the new
correct
issue.
That's correct. Problem. But if you treat the underlying trauma before the addiction is completely at hand, the addiction will resurface immediately, and it will. You have to get the addiction thoroughly treated, and then, as these guys are all telling you, then the trauma has to sort of be gently
around, brought
up in ways that can be intolerable doses, as we say.
Slowly introduced.
That's right. Yeah.
So with addiction, if it were like peeling an onion, the addiction is going to be the outside and the trauma the inner core.
I know. Well, you kind of – but I think of them as two separate
you
problems
get sober
that overlap.
And become,
two big onions.
Two big onions.
This is a question a lot of parents ask me. Yeah. I always say you have to get sober in order to become an onion, to have the insight to start – seeing the different levels of how your trauma or how your family history has created how you actuate in the world, especially in interpersonal relationships. I'm imagining, like me, what was happening at the five-year point is you lost
a relationship.
I lost more than that. My son told me he hated me and wanted to move back with his mother. I lost the relationship to another man, and my home was condemned because I refused to bring it up.
I think
to
we
code,
call that stress,
right?
Stressors. Think we
yeah,
call
normally,
that stressors.
No,
we call that stress.
That's being an asshole, and then finally you got to pay up.
It was terrifying memories coming up from my subconscious.
Sure.
Terrifying memories coming up that
right.
I could no longer stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you don't have the
and
drugs.
It's all good now, guys.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Well, it's,
Todd Zalkins, addiction specialist.
Much better.
Shelly Sprague, Bob Forrest. We're going to take a little break. We will be right back. Friends of Bergamot are back. It's, of course, a brand that's made an impact on us here. It makes a variety of supplements. They use the extract of the bergamot citrus fruit. It's full of polyphenols. It's a supplement that acts as a natural statin and may improve a number of cardiovascular conditions and fatty liver disease, as well as potentially high blood pressure and other things associated with the metabolic syndrome. Now the makers are bringing you a formulation called Bergamot Sport that provides all the same cardiovascular benefits, but with some additives designed to aid athletes and those with an active lifestyle. Bergamot Sport may help improve stamina as well as reduce recovery time and muscle inflammation. In an ongoing study, professional soccer players were asked to use Bergamot Sport, and the documented improvements have been impressive. I use the product. First Lady of Love uses the product, the Bergamot Femme. Physicians and cardiologists around the world are recommending it. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 10% on their order by entering the code DRDREW at checkout. That's Dr. Drew at checkout, all one word. To try Bergamot Sport for yourself, visit bergamet.com. That is bergamet.com. Or also you can click on the Bergamot banner at drdrew.com. Well, we're so pleased to have Hydrolite back. Hydrolite is something that we and my family use just about every day, and it is simply the best oral rehydration product I have ever seen. And there are many reasons you should keep some around. I got the flu. I relied on Hydrolite because I knew it would rehydrate me the way an IV fluid would. We all have heard about the flus and the diarrheas, and they all knock you out. Staying well hydrated is critical to getting over these conditions. Even if you manage to avoid getting infected, your schedule is half as busy as mine. Getting 8 glasses of water a day isn't likely to happen. And you don't need it if you've got the proper hydration product, Hydrolite. That is the beauty. Whether you're sick or not, you can absolutely benefit from proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. Hydrolite does this better than a sports drink or water alone.
That's right.
Better. And it comes in great flavors like orange, berry, lemonade. It's available in a pre-mixed powder. My personal preference, little effervescent tablets. You can simply drop in a bottle of water or a glass of water, and you're done. You got it, and you are rehydrated. And compared to sports drinks, Hydrolyte delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. I know. Don't buy into the hype of the brands. Use Hydrolyte. It's a better product. I'm telling you, I had intended to invent it. They got there first, so I'm all behind them. Hydrolyte solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Order Hydrolyte today, hydrolyte.com/drdrew. That is hydrolyte.com/drdrew. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydrolyte. We actually buy in bulk in our family, so we're going to click through. Believe me, just click the banner on my site and use the code DrDrew18. That is DrDrew18.
All right, we are back, and I want to take a call before we get into solving the world's problems here.
Just the drug addicts' problems.
All right, this is somebody calling for Todd. Go right ahead there. Hey, you're on the air. Whoever's name this is, I don't have. Calling for Todd.
Hey, y'all. My name is Blake Schneider. I'm with Mississippi State. How are y'all doing today?
Hey,
Blake. Hey, good.
What's going on, Blake?
Not much. So I wanted to call in, and I was hoping Todd could talk about the screening of his film that's coming up at Mississippi State. And then furthermore, if he could speak a little bit to collegiate recovery, because I'm not sure how many viewers are acquainted with collegiate recovery.
Great. Well done.
Blake. Well, first, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to call in. And we're very excited to be coming out to your school.
Where at?
We're going to be at Mississippi State at the end of March. And we're going to be screening the Long Way Back film, which we've already done at a few colleges already.
Awesome.
Amazing.
We've become really involved with the CRC, these college recovery on campus.
Is that Stacy Mathewson?
Pardon me?
Stacy Mathewson?
There's 170 college recovery communities.
That's amazing.
You should try. Hang on a second. Let me get this kid back. Because it just occurred to me. Now I put him on hold. Hey, what's your name, by the way? Oh, is this?
Blake.
Oh, no. You know what?
His name is Blake.
His name is Blake. Yeah. Hey, Blake? Blake?
Blake Schneider.
Hey, Blake. you know, there.
There we are.
You want to form an SEC sort of connection to the recovery, because I know Vanderbilt's got a big program, and
all the big universities.
We're really involved in this right now, Dr. Drew. In fact, we just got back from the University of Colorado at Boulder had a summit where 37 major universities attended, and almost 300 students from colleges all over the country attended. They screened the film, and I was fortunate, and I had the privilege to be the keynote speaker there. And we're really actively involved in carrying this message of not only awareness and education, but also with of course, sharing this hope by way of the film. And it's been a wonderful experience. And Blake, we can't wait to come out there and see you guys and talk to all you young people that are doing this deal in recovery. And for people who are wanting help and want to talk one-on-one, I'll make myself available, as I did at East Carolina, as I did out there in Colorado. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Just thinking, you guys show up for each other's football games. Put the word out.
Here's why the colleges are getting involved. So I was a part of this early on, and you got a lot of, we have a zero tolerance campus. We don't know what you're talking about. With a woman named Stacy Mathewson who lost her son in college in his dorm, and what was happening was students were getting health, you know, things, excuses to leave college to go get drug treatment, then going right back where everybody's smoking weed and drinking every night and football games or whatever. So she became an advocate to have one sober dorms put aside for people with addiction problems, right?
Fantastic.
Over 10 years, I've watched it change where all the universities want it now. Guess why, Drew? Because they're losing so much money because drug addicts who were in their university are leaving and they're losing the tuitions.
Yeah.
And so it really is about...
You know what?
Simplest solution, Las Vegas, Nevada at Reno is the first one, have an outpatient clinic in their college.
I don't care about the motivation as long as the outcome is good for people.
No, but people need to know what works, and that is outpatient in the health facility of the university and sober dorm set aside for the kids that are in it.
Yeah. The stigma of getting help, you know, it's so tough for these young people who are on campus when the places are raging and just crazy with drinking, crazy with drug use. To see these young people who are two, three, 4 years sober, it was miraculous, okay? There's 170 colleges doing this, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're active in their recovery. They're sponsoring people. I mean, it's alive. It's a grassroots thing that's amazing.
Yep, mm-hmm. I've seen it.
That's fantastic.
So let's talk about frustration and solutions.
Here we go.
I mean, but are these guys really high functioning? Because, I mean, they're in college.
They must
be high functioning kids.
I got to spend time with 50 plus of these people one on one. A lot of them, and we all know this, that a lot of these people come into recovery now as a result of narcotics. They get driven into our programs because of drugs.
Right.
They are getting the message early, and they are functioning in colleges and getting advanced degrees because you know what, they're getting the miracle.
Right.
Well, our fear is that they get the replacement therapy and then go back to college.
Are they giving us let's have the debate. Based?
No. They are active in 12-step programs, and like I said, they're going to meetings regularly. We had meetings while I was out there.
Yeah, there's meetings on these campuses.
I mean,
that's huge on
campus.
That's huge.
That's what's cool about it.
That's great. That's so heartwarming because you know my 17-year-old is going to go off to college pretty soon, you know, and I'm thinking, well, maybe she could go to college in another country because I don't know about this one.
Listen to this. Texas Tech University has the largest sober population of this program type, and get a load of this. This is so awesome. I believe there's something going on where if you stay sober, if you're proving that you're doing it, they have like actual book incentives, like $3,000 a year to help you along with your college.
Wow.
How cool.
That's phenomenal.
How cool.
That is winds so amazing. Yep. Right. Yeah, we just have to keep beating down the doors, guys. We just have to keep talking about
it. Take another call.
Well, I thought we were going to talk about Suboxone.
I know, but it was so positive. I want to keep going. James, go ahead, James.
I didn't want to shift over.
Yeah. James?
Yeah, this is James.
Hey, buddy. What's up?
Me and my wife are having kind of a crisis with one of our good friends, Diane. She was 8 years sober from pills. Well, actually, I'll just let you talk to my wife.
Okay.
There you go. That's a smart guy.
Our Diane has always been a little bit of an alcoholic, but she's functioning. She's always held down jobs and gotten her son to and from school. She had a little bit of with pain pills, but she was able to get off those on her own, and it's been about 8 years. So recently, she started dating a meth dealer.
And
I just found out from her this week that she's now injecting it.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. We've got to stop that right away.
Holy moly.
Right away.
We were riding high with your story of the colleges.
We were getting
and
some...
now the reality of what's really going on.
Yeah, but the meth thing is huge right
here's
now.
What I,
it's huge.
Here's what the, That's the, Shelley's here's thing. The issue is that if you get sober off of one thing, but you're still functioning, quote unquote, on another thing, you're a sitting duck for anything coming down the pike.
Yeah.
From a guy with some meth, and all of a sudden, there's no recovery. There has to be recovery involved in your life if you have problems, quote unquote. The minimization of I'm a functioning alcoholic. No one is a functioning alcoholic. If they function in one area of their life, that's not functioning. If they function in two areas, we have five functioning areas. There is no functioning alcoholics. If you're an alcoholic, you're only functioning barely. And if people are letting you get away with it and drive your kid around, then that's a shame. That's really a shame. Treatment needs to exist right away for this person. Methamphetamine creates mental illness, and people do not come back from it. And I have absolutely had watching people become borderline schizophrenics because they are having a good time, you know, with their new boyfriend is just not okay with me.
So she
don't mess around.
Way to go.
Yeah.
There's something sinister about that drug.
No, she's got so much meth in her program now. It's the new drug of choice.
They eventually, in almost all cases, look either manic or schizophrenic.
That's
and they start getting delusional and they start getting paranoid about everybody around them. And
I guarantee you the violence comes from the meth.
Yep.
But there's another mistake that people make, which is, oh, she's 35 now and she's outgrown it. No, it gets worse. The burden of alcoholism and the mental torment of a fractured soul gets worse as you get older. It doesn't get better. It's not alcoholism and the thinking behind it and the emotional dysregulation behind it doesn't get better with time. It gets worse. And so she was primed for something like this to happen. right?
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, you're no longer hitting happy hour. You're shooting meth. It's bad.
It's bad.
This isn't good.
So I mean, what book?
It's not okay.
What do you want, Jane? Or what's your name? I'm sorry.
I'm Michelle.
Michelle, you need to intervene immediately, and you need to not be politically correct about it.
Yeah, but how do they do that? She doesn't want treatment. She's with her boyfriend. She's paranoid, psychotic, whatever.
Then they can have better boundaries and say, I just think America needs better boundaries. And I go directly to that person and say, listen, I don't like what you're doing. I don't want my kids around you. Yeah. I don't want my kid playing with your kid, and that breaks my fucking heart.
Yeah.
But what you need help, and I'm not going to be somebody who just stands by and says, oh, she's just getting along,
this
whatever.
This isn't working for us.
Yeah.
It's not cool in our house.
Because addicts understand consequence.
Yeah.
Only.
If that.
Yeah.
Well, that's what helped with me. And, nobody wanted
and it takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, years of it. Years of consequences.
And it takes a lot of courage to do that, and there's so much fear behind it. But
I think people want to do it, but they're scared because of the political correct climate and all this.
Yeah, you should call us. We're not afraid.
Well, everyone's walking on eggshells because of the addict, and I'm sick and tired. I'm so tired of them running the show. I've had it. And just go for it. Tell them it's unacceptable.
It's unacceptable.
And get
but you
them
love them,
into,
but with love.
Definitely with love. But,
you know?
But get them in front of a professional. That's what they need. They need a professional help right away.
Right. And so
her family is would like to pretend that nothing is an issue. Her mom smoked crack with her when she was like 12 years old.
And there's the
so
trauma.
They're not supportive. She doesn't have insurance and definitely can't afford a rehab. Do I just tell her I can't be friends with her anymore? Or
is there a child involved?
Yeah, yes.
Well, that would call
the child have health insurance.
Called Child Protective Services immediately.
Wait.
I just want to make one point. This is a functioning alcoholic who doesn't even have health insurance. We've got to stop believing the lies about people.
Here's the beautiful thing about meth, though, is that it requires no detox. Okay,
yeah.
The person just needs a couple of good nights,
a little
sleep.
Seroquel. Yeah,
and tell the person that you love them. She needs help, and you have to distance yourself. But there's plenty of places, by the way, that'll take her.
Charlie Street,
you know this place?
Yeah, of course, I've taken Charlie Street. I've been there several hundred times.
Yes,
in
my new favorite place. You know Chuck Davis?
What's that? I don't know Chuck Davis.
Chuck told me about Charlie Street. You can just bring a drug addict there, Drew, with no money and no insurance.
Costa Mesa.
Yeah.
I didn't believe
a place like that.
Salvation Army.
What state are you calling from?
It's got to be a male, though, from Charlie Street.
Where?
Texas?
Colorado.
So Arapahoe House. Arapahoe House there's a series of them. They're excellent.
Great recovery.
There's lots of nonprofits.
Yeah, Arapahoe Women's Program. It's all community supported. I've gone up there and seen them and spoken to them. It's an amazing program outside of Denver, all through the Denver area. Arapahoe House, they will take her immediately for nothing. She's got to be willing, got to want to. And if she's not willing, you have an obligation
but
to call
Child
Protective Services.
You've got to take care of the kids.
She is not a fit mom if she's shooting meth.
Absolutely not.
Scary.
It's going on everywhere.
It's really scary.
So now, Bob, now you can get your – now that we've gone a little negative.
Okay. Right, so I'm going to be the Suboxone advocate because I've lost literally – over 100 kids that I had in groups with me at 19 and 21 and 22, and it changed my mind about survival, right? I'm with you and Shelly, with my friends who are 40, like, you know, yeah, you need to tough love and buck up and 12-step abstinence-based treatment. That's not the clients I'm seeing. They're not very savvy. They're not very sophisticated. They have no coping skills. They have no job skills. They have codependent parents, and they go from treatment center to treatment center, like using their insurance card like it's a Motel 6 card. Yeah. And at a certain point, when they've OD'd 7 times, been brought back with Narcan 7 times, you have to say there is a place for Suboxone in this community. I don't really want to be involved in it.
But let's call it what it is. It's harm reduction.
It's survival. It's literal physical mortality survival.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah, there's a couple arguments here, but at what point do you pull the plug on it?
Right.
At what point do you say it's robbing Peter to pay Paul? It's no different than methadone. This stuff makes you feel great. It does.
Yeah.
I've been on it.
Oh. I've never been on it.
I was on it to get off of the drugs.
And how long were you on it for?
How long was I on it?
Yeah.
7 to 10 days, and I was taken off of it. I was on Subutex.
Can you imagine staying on it for a month or 2 months or 6 months? It's impossible to get off.
Working with an intervention client who's been on it for 2 years and watching him rip off his skin with his hands.
It's terrible. It's hideous. It's hideous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm taking people off of Suboxone, and they don't want to come off it. They do not want to come off it.
Why would you? No, it makes you feel fabulous.
Yeah,
you know,
and then they're in treatment. They're telling me what time it is all day about how they don't need this and they don't need 12 steps and their addiction doesn't require that level. Somebody told me this. My addiction doesn't require that level of accountability. 12 step. I was like, whoa.
Have them stop taking it, and it's like, welcome to the world, Junior.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and thank God that I had to go through that experience of terrifying detox.
Well,
I'm glad
your
that I did.
Detox sounds just.
But I'm look.
Oh,
what I keep saying
gosh.
Is, and I'll say it: I've never in my 25 years of treating heroin addicts did these words ever come out of my mouth. We've got to find a way to detox heroin addicts. It's just not working.
No, I'm stealing that from you.
We had no trouble getting people off heroin ever. I do exactly that. I get them off too. No problem. We didn't lose heroin addicts in withdrawal.
Here's the thing about all these heroin addicts scared of heroin withdrawal. I got myself off of it while I was out of my mind 100 times with Valium, cocaine, and alcohol.
Exactly. But heroin withdrawals
are so easy to cover up. You're talking about a little bit of vodka, a couple of diazepam. And a little bit of cocaine.
Heroin addicts, part of the addiction, people don't understand. They used to talk about this in the literature.
I went into a little coma from that.
They used to have heroin have a pathological fear of withdrawal. It's a feature of the disease.
Overwhelming preoccupation with the withdrawal,
which is not that bad.
Do you think
a lot of it is because you guys, it's like, wait a minute, stop doing these opiates that are killing you, but wait a minute, I've got this thing. You're not going to feel sick anymore. Just take it every day. Just take it every day.
Yeah, of course.
Because we're of this mindset in our society that's like we're so impatient. Mm-hmm. We're in such fear of how we're going to feel. Right.
We also don't know how pathological we are. It's like I just need something to cover up my heroin addiction. What's the big deal?
I just need to stop using heroin.
That's my problem, using heroin.
But at what point do we start feeling what is real? Okay. When do we actually recognize? Because that's when we actually start to treat.
So that's the patient side. How about my peers that won't allow people to go through withdrawal or stay with them through that difficult process of learning how to feel? They won't do it.
Let's go in a different direction because we just sound like every other show about Suboxone. Here's the thing. I did some research. In 1985 is when I became a daily user, when I knew I don't want to be sick ever again, and I'm never going to. 1985. In 1985, the CDC or whatever said there were 558,000 known opiate addicts in America.
Sure.
Right? So say there was 1 million, Drew. Yeah. Say that number was wrong by half.
Yeah.
Right? Now there was a million. There are now 20 million Americans who are opioid addicts.
20 million.
Right now?
Substance use disorder.
Yeah.
20 million opiates.
That is 20 opiates. Times what it was. Now, here's what I found.
It's all prescription.
And this is just a cultural thing. Okay. That, by the way, does not count
the pain patients.
And benzodiazepine.
And the benzo addicts. So think about this.
Junkies.
Those 558,000, I guarantee you, most of them were pretty interesting and could tell a story and really knew how to have a lust for life. The last 50,000 I've met are not that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. It's everyday Americans. There is not sexual abuse and trauma like there was of those 558,000. There's this enmeshment and codependency, and they're just not – they're not seeking what addicts are seeking, right, to the fourth dimension, to thrive. They just want to be normal. So let them be on Suboxone. That's my solution.
We also had a genius marketing scheme 25 years ago, which started it all.
Yeah.
Okay. Which started the overall opiate marketing machine. We all know how it started, and it started 20 plus years ago.
Yeah. Well, it created
what we're in right now.
Well, there was more complex stuff that most people aren't aware of. As a physician, I had to experience it. They started threatening doctors with prison and fines if they didn't treat pain.
Correct.
Then they made pain the fifth vital sign. So it was as important as your pulse.
Yeah.
And then if a patient left treatment without their pain being treated, aggressively.
Who are they? The question is, who are they? You refuse to believe it was Purdue Pharmaceuticals.
How would Purdue Ouch. Have done that? How do they make the pain the
vital
stuff?
They pay the lawyers. I'm going to go meet them all.
Oh, no. They were involved. So it was lawyers and patient advocacy groups.
I'll do you one better. As anesthesiologists who couldn't find a job.
Well, that's a different thing.
That's pain management clinics. That's who was running them.
Okay. So then we became afraid to treat pain, so we sent everybody to the pain management doctors who had a professional discipline that pain is what the patient says it is,
right?
Whatever that means.
Right.
And then pain relief is what the patient says it is. And that went all the way to pain treatment being literally a menu that the patient just goes, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this, and then leaves.
Right. Now, this is what I want to ask you as a physician, Dr. Drew, and that is, at what point, though, do you draw the line when what we call the exaggeration of subjective complaints versus objective findings? Objective findings when, hey, I've got an MRI, like right now.
You're asking me as the clinician, okay. So I have to think, like, what would I say on the witness stand when the patient sues me for criminal action for inadequate treatment?
I'm trying to help you. We're on the same team here.
So to answer it, I have to think of, well, when they take the criminal action to try to put me in prison for reckless negligence because they succeeded in doing this. For inadequate treatment of pain, I have to go, well, it was my opinion. Well, are you experiencing the pain, Dr. Pinsky? Did the patient tell you they were not having pain relief? That's the ridiculousness of this.
My point being is that an MRI for like a knee strain, if my MRI shows there is no objective findings on a minor knee strain, I can't say I've got acute radical pain for a year. That's absolute BS and we know it.
But on the witness stand, they don't care. That's the problem.
Oh, that's such crap.
That's why we're in the mess we're in.
But my whole point is, and this is where Drew and I differ, is what was behind all that? Who made the money off of that? Lawyers did, right? For sure, Drew. Lawyers.
Insurers.
Oh, I know who made some money.
Anesthesiologists and pain management clinics did. And Big Pharma did.
Yep. Wow, imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
But Pharma didn't have to do anything for that all to happen. That's
the
point.
Why are they willing now to take responsibility for it?
To the lawyers?
No, the doctor's offices.
Why? What do they do? They don't come to me.
No. I'm talking about the sales reps.
Sales reps can't come into doctor's offices anymore.
They can't anymore, but they could 20 years ago.
Years ago, I'm saying, when they started it all.
And what would they do?
They would show
the trumped up BS argument that opiates don't cause addiction that Portnoy wrote.
Brainwash
doctors on cruise ships to believe
happen.
This. Purdue guy.
They do it in your office. They do it in your office, and I used to chase them out.
But that's you as an individual practitioner. Yeah. But doctors were signing up to go on these cruises, right? And I have videotape of the marketer from Purdue going, "Who wants to be a millionaire?" That's how he opened the seminar.
I saw that too.
Right?
Yeah, I saw that.
So there was profit behind it, and I believe you could connect that they were the ones funding the lawsuits.
Hey, Doc, across the board, don't you think if you took all the doctors, don't you think that really it's just a small percentage?
Yes. It's not even doctors.
I think it's 90%+ are really, really of the highest ethical, you know what I mean, with decision making.
Yes,
I think
course.
It's a small percentage that have created
I'll do you one better. A lot of the people that ran the Florida pain management clinics were not doctors. They were anesthesiologist groups.
What makes you think anesthesiologists are?
Because I've been researching
Anesthesiologists are highly trained physicians.
It's the pain management guys like in Arkansas and Kentucky where they opened these things. Ohio.
Why did they go into – why in the 90s did they go into the anesthesiologist track? Because you could make $400,000 being an anesthesiologist.
So that's 4 to 5 years.
So they were already economically motivated people.
That's true.
Then when they came out into the marketplace, there were no jobs.
No, that's not true. What happened was they could make more money doing local blocks and injectables and things, you know, these procedures. Procedural medicine took over.
But a lot of anesthesiologists, the schools opened up and there was more people becoming anesthesiologists.
No, absolutely not. We actually had a shortage. We had to have
yes. That after that shortage, people went into that. No. You believe in capitalism. That's what made the price go up to 400,000 because there was a shortage.
Right,
of them.
But they never ever had a glut. There was never a glut. They
don't make $400,000 a year now. I guarantee you that.
No, all doctor salaries went way down. It wasn't unique, and maybe because they were financially motivated, then they wanted to go out into these procedural things. So they weren't really interested in sending out prescribing pain medication. They were interested in nerve blocks and procedures and things like that.
And that's what became pain management? Did it grow out of that?
No, that is pain management. Not grow out of that. That is what pain management is. And if they couldn't get full relief with these procedures and all these things they were doing, here's some pain medicines. And that's why the menu was there, because they didn't want to deal with that. They just hear whatever you say pain control is, that's what pain control is. Choose the ones you want.
Hey, Bob, have you read the book called Dreamland?
Yes, I saw the documentary.
Have you read the book Dreamland? Yeah. That just tells all about how all those.
He's a little prejudiced too, though. But I'm always
pretty accurate
trying to,
though, about how some of those things started.
But you know, it's just fascinating to me that now Purdue is going to turn to the recovery industry to
find
a solution.
Wait.
Because they're being held accountable. They want to settle like the tobacco industry did.
Are they going to open up a big rehab center? are they going to make it all freeze at Purdue Detox?
Wait. No, I just saw
Doc,
an article.
Doc, is it true?
I don't know. Bob. Shelly's got it.
A half a million acre detox center sponsored by Purdue.
It's going to happen.
No.
Get out of Dodge.
My boss sent me something from Purdue specifically. What day
was it?
It was Josh. He sent me.
Purdue is getting into how do we rectify this situation. We had no idea of what it would cause. Oh, my gosh, we're going to be responsible. Just like the big tobacco did.
They've got a few Bitcoin. They can handle it.
Why did it take them
It says this. It was
Janssen's
USA Today.
Been out there trying to help.
It was USA Today, and it was a decision by OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma to stop encouraging physicians to write painkiller scripts is drawing positive reviews from opioid experts who caution that far more work must be done to crush the painkiller epidemic.
Yes.
And that's not a rehab center.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
They are going to.
Oh, I was aware of that article.
Purdue says it's slashing its sales.
No, the question is, they're going to be held like, what was the big tobacco two thing? $5 billion?
Oh, it's way more than that, I think.
More?
Oh, yeah, oh, it's huge.
Purdue doesn't have
$14 billion.
Yeah, I think it's 14 or 22,
makers,
I think it went up to at some point.
It says Purdue is facing hundreds
of lawsuits.
So
they want the lawsuits.
Many are probably class action kinds of lawsuits.
Yeah. So anyways, I believe, yes, we all now can track how it happened. The question is what to do about it.
What are we going
to
do about it?
And my take is the 3 or 4 million people that I believe are real addicts, like the book says, real alcoholics, I believe there's a lot of people that don't have the fundamentals, especially the young people who aren't the fundamentals. They don't even understand AA, let alone comprehend it and act on it and really understand it.
But,
so they're not going to do AA, I guarantee you.
But I go to some groups that a lot of young people are getting sober.
Yes, they are, because there's 20 million of them.
But it's cool that a lot are getting it.
Yes, yeah, a lot are getting it, but a lot are not.
A ton aren't.
Yeah.
And a ton won't.
Of those ton that aren't, do we want them to die at 20? Or do we want them
No, we don't want anyone to die at 20, Bob.
Well, then
we can't be
adamantly against
Suboxone. I'm not.
None of us are. You
were. I just call it what it is, which is harm reduction. Harm reduction.
It's not so much being against Suboxone. I'm just saying if you're on it long term, it's not true sobriety. If it prevents you from putting a needle in your arm for the rest of your life and dying from an OD, wonderful.
And so that's Todd's version. And my version is I'm concerned about the excessive enthusiasm for it, that it's given to everybody all the time.
Because there's money to be made off it.
Because they don't know what addiction is. They've never seen a treatment of addiction. All their idea of a treatment of addiction
is Suboxone. Right.
Yeah. Period. End. Yeah. And by the way, if my profession were doing such a great job of responding to their understanding of addiction, why is Tom Petty dead? Why is Prince Cornell dead? Why is Prince dead? Mm-hmm. Same exact behavior, giving drug addicts opiates and benzodiazepines.
Let me just read you another factor this friend of mine sent me who works in addiction counselor. He said about the Suboxone, promotion, all this, that he deals with hundreds of these young people. Do the doctors know that they are not going to take their meds as prescribed? Do they know that they're not? They're going to sell them and trade them.
My doctors do. Our doctors.
How are they testing for other drugs?
Because
70% of Suboxone users are using another drug.
Well, we don't We test 3 times a week.
What do you test for?
Everything.
Okay, good.
We send it to the lab.
You observed?
Observed. Yes, okay. Yes. Okay.
Most places don't do that.
I know, because it's a pain in the ass. And number two, people run in droves from the treatment facility because they're really giving them treatment.
Yes, right.
They're running from me. They're like, why are we having a 50% AMA rate? I'm like, because I'm doing real treatment here.
Yeah.
That's why. Because I'm asking them to test 3 times a week, and because I'm asking them to be accountable and responsible, because I'm asking them to show up every day.
Also on Suboxone?
My gosh.
A lot of them are also on Suboxone?
No. I literally only have 15% of the entire population on Suboxone.
That's what
which
it should be.
Normal.
Yeah, it's about right. It should be 15%,
20%. But I'm having people come into the detox and say, do you use Suboxone here? Before they know anything.
Of course.
And
it's
when my doctor says, no, I don't think we're going to go that route with you. Oh, they start talking to the other clients. They're like, he's getting Suboxone. Why am I not getting Suboxone?
Shelly, if you remember, that's why I didn't allow it on our unit.
I know.
The splitting behaviors are so crazy.
If
you have an opiate on the unit of any stripe, the splitting goes, you can't run a program.
It's through the roof.
That's why I didn't do it. It wasn't that I had massive objections to
Suboxone.
It's true. Remember, I used to send people upstairs to the other unit and say, get it there.
I wish I had another unit to send them to. Trust me. Please.
Because it wasn't.
Send them to Aloe House.
Yeah.
Send them to you.
I'm starting a whole Suboxone track.
Let's talk about
You start the Suboxone trap. I'm going to start the abstinence-based track.
But they're going to all be amongst themselves, not with sober people.
Okay, good.
Hang a second. Let me ask my producer. Sorry. We have a bunch of calls.
How are we doing?
Go with the calls.
We have a movie to talk about.
Let's go
to calls here. Okay.
All
right, here we go.
Oh, I'm happy being with you guys.
We're happy you're here.
I like this.
All right, this is...
this is fun, right? This is good.
I like you guys.
It's fun.
What's wrong with you? Albert, is that you? Albert.
Yeah, how you doing, Dr. Drew? I called in a little while ago about Steven. You remember me?
I'm not sure. Please go. Keep going. I'm sure my memory was not so good these days.
It was with you and Jason Ellis about the marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, I have my own personal problem. I end up getting on prescription pills because of a doctor. I suffer from a medical condition where I have rhabdomyolysis. You familiar with that condition, Dr. Drew? Rhabdomyolysis.
Well, rhabdomyolysis is a acute condition, and then it goes away. So why are they still treating you with opiates?
Yeah, I have because of genetics. It wasn't something, you know, like because it's something I have genetically.
Do you have McArdle's disease or something like that?
Or it was tested for mitochondrial myopathy, and that was secondary. But my doctor at the Cleveland Clinic said I had rhabdomyolysis, and that's what he considered the primary condition. But they don't really have an acronym to why I have it. Just like he said, genetically.
All right. So you have something like myotonic dystrophy or something like that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, when I went to the hospital and stuff when I was younger, they give me, you know, things like morphine shots and things like that. Ooh. When I was in rhabdo, my CPK, the creatine kinase would be like, you know, like 800, or, you know, sometimes it go up to 1,000. But I didn't really get into painkillers. I didn't really, you know, care for that stuff. And then they kept giving it to me. And then I realized, I said, you know, I don't want to do it. But then it just made me feel happy, so I kept doing it.
And you know, CPK of 1,000.
That's what happened.
Hey,
that's
Albert.
What happened.
Todd just talked about how happy it makes you feel.
And somebody.
Until it doesn't.
Somebody got you a little messed up on your rhabdo, too. I mean, a CPK of 1,000 is not very high. Rhabdo is, you know, tens of thousands.
We're not giving out medical advice here.
And so it concerns me that they, you know, again, they strung you out on an opiate. But please get help for that.
Well, no, it makes for happy customers, right?
Compliance.
Drugs make for happy customers.
Do you know the new problem with the pain is the fifth vital sign? We don't have that anymore. Now that people look at that and go,
patient satisfaction scales. We've got to get rid of those, too.
Patients have you lose your job as a doctor if your patient doesn't say you did everything I wanted you to do. So yeah, right. You can't treat a drug addict like that.
That's right.
We lost Todd.
Carf and Jaco.
If I would, I'm trying to think back to when I would. When I would go to a doctor in the 80s, when I would go to a doctor, like somebody tell me, oh, you can go to this doctor and get a bunch of pills. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And I'd go there and they'd look at me and go, get out of the office. They wouldn't even let me see the doctor. Could I have sued them? Because I had green dreadlocks.
It
maybe that was it.
No. They would give me Darvocet.
That might have something to do with it.
They'd be like, here's some Darvocet.
Yeah, it might have been the T-shirt.
Like, what?
Yeah.
No, but, they wouldn't.
So that wasn't illegal back then to tell them get out of their office.
They'd have to refer you or maybe you were, I don't know. Jay, what's up?
Perfect, man.
Jay?
Hello.
Jay, hey.
Jay, what's up?
Yo, how's it going? Is Z-Man there?
There he is right there.
Hey, what's up, Jay?
Yeah, hey, Z-Man, this is J-Dubs, man. We met at Romy Rome's Cancer Benefit Show a couple years back.
Hey, hey.
I just had a quick question here. How's the Bradley House going?
Hey, thanks for calling in,
Bradley
man.
Bradley House?
Yeah,
what's that?
That's our nonprofit. Our nonprofit treatment center that's going to be opening at the end of 2018.
Treatment center or sober living?
It's a treatment center.
Wow!
It's in Bradley Knoll's name. It's
where'd you get the dough for that?
We're raising it right now.
Where's it going to be?
It's called Bradley's House.
It's got to be in Long Beach, right?
The Knoll Family Foundation is the umbrella of it. It'll be opening in South Orange County. It'll be a 6-bed facility, and it will be treating. Male musicians in Bradley Knoll's name.
Wow. Congratulations.
So, yeah, man, expect to see this by the end of this year. We have a major music benefit coming out in about a couple of months with some A-list musicians.
Place is
going to be, it's going to be rocking. And in a couple months, we're going to know exactly where some major players are going to be out there.
Is Music Cares wrapping in with you guys?
We just met with Music Cares. Good. We're going to be associated with them. But, you'll be hearing about it, brother, I promise.
That's so amazing.
That's
I look
great.
Forward to it, man. I appreciate everything that you've been doing for the community. I appreciate everything that Skunk Records has been doing for the community. Miguel gave me some good words of advice while I was out there. He said, it's not what you do in the industry, it's what you don't do.
Right on, man. Hey, thank you so much for reaching out, brother. Take care.
Wow, that's so cool.
That's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's a project of the heart for sure. We're excited about it. It's the first treatment center of its kind.
It's another Christina calling in. Christina, go ahead.
Christina?
Oh, hi, guys. Love you. Love y'all and love what you're doing with the community and recovery. Thank you so much. And also, I've been trying to reach out to my local... I'm going to take y'all... I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I hope that's better. My local Santa Cruz radio station trying to get Z-Man up here because Santa Cruz has a huge heroin epidemic.
Yes, they do.
But, yeah, so...
Hey, Christina, how you
hoping
doing?
Hoping to get you up here. I just wanted to just... I don't have a question. I just want to encourage everyone out there. I am a happy as can be, recovering alcoholic. I have 6 years, 6 months, awesome. 16
Congratulations.
Days.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Well done.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Awesome.
And continuous sobriety. And I haven't had a relapse as of yet.
Good
Hopefully
for you.
Never. But I just wanted to encourage everyone that may be still struggling with addiction or, you know, mental health or whatever is going on, that you can maintain your sobriety even when, I don't know if you can cuss or whatever, but when stuff goes bad, I lost my brother, my eldest brother. I lost him to cold turkey withdrawal. He was heroin addict for 22 years.
His heart
got really enlarged, and he was trying to kick cold turkey. On the fourth day, he had a heart attack. On the way to the hospital, he had a heart attack. So,
how
old was he?
Yeah.
He was 42 at the time, and he was just 3 months shy of his 43rd birthday. But he had been using drugs since he was about 12 years old, and he started using heroin when he was 21. So I just wanted to let everybody know that it's possible to stay sober, even though things can get horribly wrong, you know, horribly, horribly dark and sad. I sat there and I watched him die. I begged him. You know, bargained with God. I did all those things while he was dying. And I just wanted to let everybody know that it can get really, really bad, you know, and you can still spread the message that recovery is possible and you can maintain that recovery even though the darkest of the dark can happen. And I just want to say thank you to everybody on the panel for everything that you're doing. And I hope Bradley's house goes off without a hitch. And I just love you guys.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Thank you very much.
That's very
She's
cool.
absolutely right. There's nothing out there that we cannot get through together.
Well, but yeah. You know, it goes back to something Bob and I have talked a little bit about. I think even last time you were in here, we talked about the fact that in this country, not that Christina's talking about so ordinary a phenomenon, but we've lost the ability to tolerate ordinary misery. Like, life sucks sometimes, and she's talking about some particular sucky stuff, but even less sucky miseries, we just refuse to go through it. We just, like, it doesn't happen. We don't. Well, why is this happening? It's just life has – it's part of the life experience is misery.
Yeah, especially you know, we think as alcoholics and addicts that we want to self-manage, and often we do it not so successfully. You know, in my first year of recovery, I was 3 days away from my 1 year sober anniversary, and my father committed suicide, my alcoholic father. And guess what? A community of sober people held me up.
Yeah.
It was the best thing of all time.
Absolutely.
You guys. They all loved me through it, and I walked through it with dignity and grace.
Yeah.
And so that's what we do together.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And I've had many, many losses and many difficulties. My daughter was born with a congenital heart defect, and AA absolutely carried me. The people in those rooms carried.
What did she have?
She had transposition of the great vessels.
I didn't even know that. Did she? What? Was she
yeah,
operated?
You did.
Yeah, no, she had open heart surgery when she was 36 hours old, and she was at Cedars. We were at Cedars, thank God. And the people in the program literally carried me, brought us
just flocked
food,
in. I bet
just came in every day while we were there. You know, she was in ICU for two, three weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a very, very difficult experience. Oof. But I was sober. My husband at the time was sober, and we walked through it with the program. And I can't separate the fellowship from the magic and the miracle of the 12-step community. I can't separate it because the people showed up for me.
Yeah.
People I didn't even really know very well showed up for me in that hospital, and I will never forget that. And I'm forever grateful for the people in the program that helped me through that time, because everybody was afraid, obviously, that you know I wasn't gonna rebound from that and we weren't gonna make it, but we did. And she's 17, and she's looking at colleges.
Strength in numbers, you know?
And that's what we need to encourage more. Like, that's what. So if you open a rehab center in Los Angeles, bad marketing tool is to say it's abstinence-based, 12-step-based. So if you go on websites of all the rehabs in L.A. and Orange County, they'll say they don't insist on it. They deprioritize it, right? Because I don't think the kids who are going to rehab have experienced the magic that we're talking about. Mm. They need to experience it.
Right,
big time.
Right. And yeah, it is an experience. That's for sure.
It is.
And it's hard. To, you know, the times that I've really gone out of my way to make sure they experience it, they are forever changed. So you're right
That's
in that
true.
Respect. But machine rehabs, spitting them out into the 12-step meetings
does not work. No.
You need to be brought there. When I think about who – Brendan Mullen took me to my first AA meeting in 1984.
Wow.
He didn't stay for three more days.
Right, but he took
But I
you.
Was forever changed by that. Yeah. I kept going for 12 years loaded.
Yeah,
you understand?
I remember the Lotus.
So we need to make sure that young people know the magic that we're talking about.
Bob went to a meeting and drank a 6-pack of beer.
Yeah, yes. Shelly was there.
and we said,
keep coming back, Bob. Keep coming back.
That's what they said to him as he was leaving.
Keep coming back.
Is that right? Yeah.
Nobody kicked us out.
Oh, and people are stealing your thunder, man. Some people come in, they do even crazier stuff. They get up at the podium, they start talking about how AA sucks, and we have to just sit there. I was a secretary of a meeting one time, and came up and was like saying how bad AA was and fuck you. And, and I was like, okay. Maybe just keep coming back.
Wow.
Don't worry.
Okay. I got to say, if you're going to do that at any meeting, do it the one where Shelly's the secretary.
Yes.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. Okay. That actually have a therapeutic element to it. Let me, I'm trying to get our next caller up here. It's the computer that doesn't cooperate with. This is Juanita. Juanita has an interesting question.
Hi. Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're good. This refines our harm reduction conversation a little bit. Go ahead, Juanita.
Yeah, hi. I've been in recovery for 29 years.
Wow.
Congratulations.
And I used to work in recovery. And when I learned it old school, it was work the steps or die, motherfucker.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So what she brings, but by bringing that up, she brings up a really interesting point that has not been addressed and not been researched, which is by creating an easier, kinder way, are we maybe doing a disservice?
Sure we are.
I think it all depends upon the individual.
Because the people that I came into the rooms with, a whole lot of us are still clean.
Yeah.
30, yes. 35
right.
years.
Right.
I mean, there was no choice. We hung out with a bunch of old Irish guys in AA. And they were serious as a heart attack. They wouldn't even let us speak in meetings.
No, no.
Because they said, we have nothing to say because we didn't have no clean time.
They're like, shut up, put your ass in the seat. Shut up, don't speak.
I had an old-time guy say to me one time, what time is it, Bob? And I looked at my watch and he goes, you still got a watch. What the fuck are you doing here?
Okay.
I try to
combine the two takes. I try to combine them because there is a time and a place to come at them with sit down. You have nothing to share. Mm-hmm. I need you to put
cotton in your ears.
Exactly.
Out of your mouth.
Put it in your mouth. Yeah. And there is a time and a place for that. But then there's a time and a place for a little bit more of a finesse. And I think bringing the two together has been the success that I've had. But at the same time, it doesn't always, it's not always going to work.
That's the clinical acumen and magic, which is deciding, you know,
who
gets what when.
Yeah,
it's not easy.
I can appreciate that old school method. And at the same time, our text also says that meetings are a place for new people to share their problems. I don't expect.
Working in recovery, though,
I don't expect solution.
If you came in high or drunk in a program, you had to leave.
Absolutely.
You could go to detox.
Absolutely.
In the, 24 hours or 72 hours, and you could come back to the program. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't stay there high. And I was looking at the timeline, and you guys were talking about Suboxone, giving patients pills and things in the program.
Yeah.
I can't have somebody in the house as high because they're going to take somebody that's clean out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my biggest
concern.
These are the
nuances of all this.
It's every day. It is tough work. It is tough work every day.
Yes.
She makes a great point.
Yeah.
Hey, Juanita, congratulations. I appreciate you calling.
Thank
it was
you
a great
so
point.
Much.
And keep the great
going.
Work.
So
thank you guys.
Thank you.
So what happened? What changed treatment was what I thought was going to be the salvation for American addiction, which was the Parity Act and Obamacare. When Obamacare was held up at the Supreme Court and going to be the law of the land, that is what brought the profit into rehabs. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, there was no profit. If you owned a rehab center, you were like doing God's work and you were breaking even
just
or making a salary,
getting
by. What I thought would be a solution to all what I saw the rising addiction problem in America became probably one of the worst things that could have happened. And that is people going to treatment who don't want to be there because they don't have a place to live, rehab shopping, patient brokering. This all happened because of what I thought was going to be the solution. I think we need to look at where do we go from here. Because letting kids use their Aetna PPO insurance cards as a housing voucher
8 times a year.
To go to the best place that lets them do the most amount of fun things, that's where we're at now.
Yeah.
And so we have to change it. We have to change
regulation.
And what we're talking about now is finding that balance. Shelley's found that balance. I've kind of tried to find a balance. I never really could because I have employees and they want to get paid. And I have mortgages, and they have to be paid. And so if you're going to lose 50% of the people that you work so hard to get into your treatment center just by having a hard line or a tough-ass approach, you're going to be shortly out of business and laying off 106 people. And that's the truth of the industry, right? And so we need to figure out a way. And my only solution is to build up the mom and pops. to build them up, to tell everyone about them. These are the greatest programs. Don't believe your kid. Your kid's a lying sack of shit. Do not believe that they're being mean to her or him. You know what I mean?
Totally. Because
parents buy into the things the addict kids say about the rehab.
Oh, completely.
Oh, yeah.
Completely.
Right?
Of course.
They're mistreating me, man. They, the cancer did this. It's like, your child is a lying criminal. They haven't stopped because the they've got 6 days
like
sober.
Hearing that.
But he's doing so well. Johnny's got 6 days. He hasn't changed.
Right.
Yeah. He's not killing it yet.
But there's people using here. Here's another one they always say. There's people using here. I got to get out of here.
Yeah, there's drug addicts here. They might be using.
Right.
It's possible. It's
so tough. You know, we need to strengthen parents.
Yeah, there's a bar down the street. They might be drinking there too.
Yeah, right.
Well, so, we have so much influential, you know, folks in you know, treatment, and it's like they gravitate towards what they're looking for. You know, so I have kids who come in who are really looking for the solution. They're really looking for sobriety. And they're really done. And I try to build those guys up.
Yeah.
And I try to really build those guys. And I try to get them vocal in those groups. Let's start talking about the solution. What do you guys do?
I call that letting them do your dirty
work.
Yeah,
like let's get that, you know, and just try to bring those
kids
up.
You understand that, Drew?
Because they really understand each other much more than they can understand me. They look at me. They go, you've never done nothing. You don't know anything about it. anything. You don't know anything. And I'm like, okay, maybe I don't. But your friend over here, he knows things. Look, he likes the same bands as you. He likes the same things as you. Like maybe, well, he's going to meetings. Why don't you go with him? Yeah. You know, why don't you take a look? But it's like so much finesse work with these guys. You know, it used to be a little bit more simple when you didn't have so many conflicting messages out there. It used to be a little bit easier. You could say, here, get in the van. Like Bob, you know, would say like, oh, get in the van. You know, everybody needs to get in the van and go to the meetings, and it was simple because that was what we provided
when we went to
rehab.
Van,
right,
get in the van represents you're going to a meeting. I don't care if you don't like them.
That's
get
right.
in the van.
Yeah.
That was an old black flag term that you know.
Absolutely.
Well. So my statement was get in the van. Or Drew's thing, which was so great to have a boss like him support the clinicians. Then fucking leave. If you don't want to be here, leave.
It's very simple.
It's simple.
If you want to be part of this treatment program, fine.
Yeah. Go.
No conversation.
Yeah. Are you in
or out?
Are you in?
But when we would say that, say in 2005, there was only about 6 rehabs in the eastern part of LA County, right? They weren't there wasn't 100 to go
also,
to.
Also, you got to remember these places are motivated to keep people because they keep collecting.
That's a terrible incentive.
That's terrible. You got to be ready to discharge.
But why we could say that at Los Encinas cuz we were it was the coolest place. You could go to PRC, Bishop Good. What was John's place up in the hill there by the golf course? And turned out he had a fake identity. Remember
that?
So there was only like 4 they could go to, and there were way harsher programs than ours. So then there's I'll get in the van.
Yeah. All right, I'll get in.
We got a ton of great emails here from our contact list. Let me just do a couple of them real quick.
Okay.
These are sort of – we have very limited time, so it's kind of light lifting I want to get into here. It's somebody in recovery 4 months and 20-plus days. Still having days where I'm either really, really happy, and then the next I'm really low. How long for this just to bugger off?
How long has it been? How long has it been?
4 months. Four and a half. 5 months.
Like eight months.
What were you using? How old are you?
Opiates.
And how long?
Opiates. Yeah. You're light. You're...
Eight more months of that, and then it'll start to even out, and then you're going to hit a brick wall like a 4 years, 5 years sober. So get ready for that one.
That's true.
Exercise.
Well, five, seven, ten, and 20.
Exercise.
Good.
Exercise.
Good.
Get those endorphins going.
Attend to your sleep. But it's like, but I mean, really exercise though, just like where you have enough so that it affects your sleep.
Really exercise.
Yeah, and
coffee and cigarettes help too.
Take some
not late in the day.
Take some action too.
Let's be honest.
Get a tablet and write some stuff down.
When I was in my first year, I drank 8 cups of Starbucks coffee a day.
Did they have Starbucks then when you got sober?
Are you still drinking coffee?
No, I don't drink coffee at all now.
Really? Whatever.
Wasn't this like 7-Eleven?
I remember him using, believe me.
She's got the double whammo 5 shots of espresso.
Nitro brew.
I love it. Oh, I love that.
I was going to ask you, that is radical.
Look at how dark it is. No milk.
Could you fill it? Put that in my car. I could probably get to Arizona.
I know, Todd, when Sublime blew by, you know, they were not super well behaved because they were using and stuff like that. But let me tell you something. Nothing compared to Bob Forrest when he would show up. That was like having a wild animal in your bed and a tornado at the same time.
I didn't like sitting down in his studio. I'd walk around, and Drew would be so nervous. I could see because I know him that well, and he'd be like, "You need to sit down."
Because he'd go out and shoot. He'd go out and start slamming.
He made the Tasmanian devil look like Jerry Garcia.
Absolutely.
It's funny.
No, absolutely. But, it's like, and it was, and I actually had to end our relationship with him because he was too.
Because I was going to beat up a guy who deserved beaten up.
A caller.
Oh, no, the guest. That's was when you guest? Formally banned
Well,
me
I was
forever.
Like, I was like, this guy's
the
going
guy
to
was
die.
Advocating having sex. Remember the with his wife and
I
all
don't
that
remember,
kind of.
But all I remember is you.
Anyways, I went down to the studio. I was at my house. I went down to the studio. I was going to beat the guy up, and Drew was like, "That is it with him."
He just remembers you, Bob.
All right, here's another one. I can't believe I get blah, blah, blah. No, here's another one. All right, what can we learn from Tom Petty's life and death? Will that end back to addiction? Do you think it could have been depression from the heart disease, the emphysema? Could pain have been treated with surgery?
Well, let's just touch on it lightly. So,
yes.
So when the solution is worse than the problem, which death is worse than pain, you have pain. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Is we got to start thinking about how we allow our friends to perish from drugs, especially particularly fentanyl and pain management.
But here's
all the while making pain so much more a risk factor, a problem than death.
Here is the fact. Opiates are not a treatment for chronic pain. That is a fact.
They cause pain.
They make pain worse over time. They do not treat.
You can't convince
pain.
The people
worse.
Taking it that.
When they are drug addicts, you can't convince them of that.
Convince now, them before.
What about for the acute stage?
For acute pain, it's great. It's wonderful for acute pain. It's actually designed for acute
three
pain.
3 days.
Right. Chronic
that's
pain.
It.
Right.
There's a their pain has two components. You were talking about your MRI earlier. Mm-hmm. Pain has a somatic component, which is what you see on the MRI, and it has a affective component, which is in a part of the brain called the insular cortex, which is sort of the misery piece of pain. So there's a somatic pain, and then there's the misery and anxiety.
I have the misery piece.
The misery.
I got that piece. Bad.
And the misery piece is amplified by trauma.
Okay. Yeah,
so,
I got that.
So it's unregulated because of trauma, right? You get
unregulated
it?
Unregulated misery
and it gets worse under the influence of opiates over time.
Hello.
And that's how we get into people with trouble. And if you're a drug addict, imagine that paradigm, and your disease is now active, it's game on.
So one solution could be that doctors become more educated about that.
Yes.
Because I can't believe that Prince's doctor doesn't feel remorse. I'm sure the gal or guy does. I'm sure they do.
And here's how it goes
I've
down.
I've met doctors whose here's clients have died.
Do you want to know how it goes down? You know how it goes down? I told him not to take that extra Xanax. He should never have taken the extra Xanax. If he hadn't taken that Xanax, it's like, no. No.
It's too late.
It wasn't the extra
Xanax.
What
about Michael Jackson's physician? I mean, he housed one for – I mean, we can go on and on with this stuff.
Yes, we can.
I don't think Tom Petty chose that route as an exit. I don't
– Obviously not.
I don't think that wonderful human being wanted to perish.
I don't think he understood the
risk. He had a lot of stuff in his symptoms. You guys saw the –
The
toxicology report was horrible.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Doctors had to prescribe those.
Every one of them.
That is correct.
Yeah.
He wasn't seeking.
Nope.
He was prescribed.
Yep. That's insane.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's beyond insane to me.
It's another tragedy.
A lot of stuff. I was blown away when I saw.
But there's lots of that going on out there.
Yeah.
Lots of it. And when he talks about Purdue and blah, 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 that has nothing to do with it. That's my profession. That's it.
Well, agreed.
What are you going to do about your profession?
I'm trying to raise awareness.
I know.
I feel so bad about it.
But don't you think there's a lot of doctors that have had clients die like this and they're starting to have remorse?
Yes.
I don't care
about remorse. I just change the behavior. That's all I'm concerned with. Just change the behavior.
They're having worry of doing it again. I guarantee you that. Prince's doctor is, I bet you he's very wary of prescribing fentanyl.
Yeah, I hope so.
But who prescribes fentanyl on an outpatient basis?
I was taking 2,400 micrograms of fentanyl for over 4 years.
Good times.
On top of 16 to 18 oxys a day.
Did you take any benzo with that?
Oh, yeah. I was taking benzos,
too. You were lucky.
That's why I didn't sleep for 44 days in my first
year. You're lucky you
didn't sleep for 44 days.
Very lucky.
That's all in the movie, The Long Way Back.
44.
The movie was so great.
All right.
44 is crazy. I was 18. Bobby, how much? How many days didn't you sleep?
Which week, time?
Weeks.
18 days.
Yeah. I couldn't speak for like the first 5 months.
I was in jail. It was days blur together. Yeah,
awesome. All right. Enough war stories, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry. We are going to wrap this thing up.
I just want to say congratulations on everything that you're doing. Your movie is fantastic.
Thank
it's very brave. I want everyone to watch it. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. Really, really think you're fantastic.
Is there a website you would be able to go to as well?
Absolutely. Longwaybackfilm.com. And if you want to check out Bradley's house, go to the Knoll Family Foundation.org.
K-N-O-L-L?
Oh, it's N-O-W-E-L-L.
Ooh. Knoll.
Knoll. Okay.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I never know.
The Knoll
Family. N-O-W-E-L-L. Okay. And, and you guys?
Good. Oh, you know, Bill.
We'll see you around.
You know.
We're around.
All right. Look for Bob on Dr. Oz Show. Bob's going to see Dr. Oz.
Oh, fantastic. All
right. In a debate, I'm actually reversing my roles. I'm anti-Suboxone on the Dr. Oz Show.
Is that right?
For that.
We'll see.
Because I can argue both sides.
I'm glad you're doing that.
A good debate.
Yeah. You're going to be perfect.
Thank you so much.
They wanted me to do it, and I said, I got the guy for you.
I want to go as his bodyguard.
Yeah.
Well, it's up to you guys.
And then I'm going to this opiate convention, right? And we'll talk about it. Go to Dr. Oz.com,
let the family of pods there. Let me get my outro. Do I have it somewhere?
Can I get my website really quick? If anyone wants to get a hold of me, please go to, go to toddzalkins.com if anyone wants to contact me about any of this film stuff or nonprofit stuff. It's been a pleasure being on with you guys.
He's the real deal.
Todd, the real deal.
But I want to remind everybody
to keep that thing going.
Just remind everybody, go to dr.com, the family of pods there. We appreciate you clicking through on the banners. Check out the Bergamet guys that get discounts there, discounts with Hydrolite. No.
I want some Bergamet.
The Hydrolite guys.
I can choose either side.
Bergamet Pro. Oops, a good catch. Well done. All right, and you know where to go. Go to dr.com, see all the stuff there. We got the opioid article coming out in dribs and drabs, but it's comprehensive. So
I
see you there. Thanks.
Cool.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you kindly.
All righty.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at drdrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.